This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 46th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is You Are What You Do. I'm joined by David G. White, Jr., the author of Disrupting Corporate Culture, How Cognitive Science Alters Accepted Beliefs About Culture and Culture Change and Its Impact on Leaders and Change Agents. The publisher is Routledge. David is a cognitive anthropologist working with organizations on culture, change, and leadership issues. He's a co-founder of Ontos Global, a boutique consulting firm. David previously held leadership roles at Microsoft, Mercer, and IBM. Besides having also co-founded an HR technology company, David is notable for being a professional jazz musician with 7 CDs to his credit. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Looking forward to this conversation. So give us a brief overview of what your book is about.
The book is about trying to bring some science and some a little bit of rigor to this topic of corporate culture, which has been extremely popular and well written about over the last 30 years, but ironically little understood. And and that is because there's a lot of sort of urban myth and urban legend about culture. It's a field dominated by consultants and executives who, you know, have good intentions to, turn their companies into successful and profitable enterprises, and they see culture as the vehicle for that. But there's not a lot of science in that field. And what's been happening outside of the world of business in fields like cultural neuroscience and cognitive anthropology and cognitive sociology and linguistics and other related fields is, with respect to culture, has been very exciting. A lot of exciting things have happened over the last 30 years. Very few of those advances in the science and the literature in those fields has seeped down into the world of business and corporate culture. So this book is an attempt to bridge that gap.
Okay. So I'm going to start really big picture. I had a guest on recently talking about what she dubbed the feeling economy, which was a different way of looking at the fourth industrial revolution. She was arguing that with the advances in AI, artificial intelligence, thinking will be taken over more by the algorithms and the machines, and feeling is something human beings are going to have to look at. You got your own take on what the fourth industrial revolution is going to look like and what it's going to mean for us, particularly in context of corporate culture. Can you describe why our current understanding of corporate culture is so inadequate to the challenges ahead?
Yeah. I'm not sure that thinking will ever be completely replaced by machines. Maybe I'm just a Luddite that way. But as I say in the book, the advent of the fourth industrial revolution puts frontline managers on the forefront of change and transformation of their organizations like never before. The tax on the emotional and psychological tax on leaders in organizations as they try to transform their industrial companies into digital companies, or their retail e-commerce companies into logistics companies, et cetera, is just, the change, the magnitude of the change is astounding, with technologies that bring, the merging of the brain and the somatics with sensing devices, with chips, the chips on everything, including chips in animals like cows. I mean, the convergence of these various different technologies is astounding. So the pressure on humans in organizations is really significant. So this puts culture at the forefront of those who are interested in transforming their organizations. And that's the argument I make in the book. It's now more than ever, you know, the need to understand and work with culture is never been greater, yet the tools and understanding has never been less, you know, or again, because of these myths and urban legends about what culture is.
Okay, so I'm going to go into the solutions or the progression of that in a moment, but I think we'll start with the status quo and why we have these limitations on us right now. So in particular, you mentioned five myths. Culture starts at the top. Culture is a physical thing. One company, one culture. Culture is what we say we care about, and culture is employee well-being. So we probably want to dive at least a little bit into two or three of those at a minimum. I'm going to start with the fourth one. Culture is what we say we care about, because actually an upcoming guest has a chapter on culture written by people who are, you know, been in the corner suite and so forth. And they talk a lot about stated values and then trying to model those values. Why is that fourth myth so pernicious?
Yeah, this is actually very, very good that you mentioned that, because this is a very common refrain that executives make. If we just model the values that we want somehow by osmosis, they will trickle down through the organization magically. Now, first off, let me just begin by saying there's no literature in the 100 years of anthropologists studying culture. There's no support for the idea that leaders somehow set the culture or that culture can be modeled by behavior. No society in millennia has a recording or has there been evidence of that being the case. It seems to be something that's been invented by consultants and executives to espouse or extend the espoused set of values that they hold for themselves and perhaps wishfully for their company. There's nothing wrong with wanting to make your organization, you know, mold it in your own image or leave a legacy of goodness and such that you might, you know, want to say we should all be this way or that way based on, you know, the values that we hold or that I hold as a chief executive. But it's myth. It's first off, it's very difficult to impose one's values on another. Generally speaking, a community's values, a social community's values, when they align with that of a leader's, what happens is the values are already in place to begin with. So for example, if you are a engineer and you become chief executive of an organization, but you've grown up as a software engineer and you run a software engineering business, it's very likely that your values are going to align with those of the organization. But that is much more a feature of the professionalization of the executive and of the organization itself. So it's very hard to impose values. It's very hard to impose norms unless they're already pre-existing in the population. So the main idea is that this is an urban myth that has been perpetrated by executives to try to make their companies more aligned for profit and for good, or ostensibly for good. Remember, culture was really an invention. The construct was invented by it came out of the theory Y thinkings of Douglas McGregor at MIT in the late 1970s. The theory Y being, of course, the antidote to theory X, which was the idea that humans are essentially unmotivated creatures and need to be driven and controlled. This was the feature of this was the common wisdom of organizational behavior dating back to 1900 and Frederick Taylor. And Doug McGregor came along and said, no, you know, humans are essentially creative. We are creative creatures. We have infinite capacity to learn and grow. And so the role of the manager is to just create an environment where that's enabled in organizations. And so from that theory, why idea sprung this idea of corporate culture, which really was an invention borrowed from the social sciences to try to teach executives or impart this idea to executives that if they just create the right environment for their organizations, great things will follow. And so this is where we are today.
Sure. So it sounds like we've hit on at least two of those myths, which is culture starts at the top, and then, well, you know, culture is what we say we care about. You had three other ones. Culture is a physical thing, one company, one culture. and culture is employee well-being. You want to choose just maybe one of those three to go after?
Sure. The culture is employee well-being is also a common refrain. The other two are relatively straightforward to understand, but this idea that somehow culture is how people feel is there's also no support for that in the literature. Certainly how people feel relates to culture in some way, as it relates to leadership in some way, but it's not a linear algorithm. It's not A plus B equals C. Often the way people feel in an organization could be a reaction to a deeper, more pervasive cultural phenomena, as much as it could be an expression of it. So for example, we have a client here in the San Francisco Bay Area, a tech company that talks about and values collaboration and wants people to be collaborative and wants them to feel part of a team. And also it's always espousing this idea of teamwork and wants, you know, essentially that attitude to pervade through the organization. In our research there, we found that teamwork idea is actually a reaction to or a compensation for something much deeper in the culture, which is this idea of craft. It's a tech company dominated by engineers and data scientists. And the value of craft is as in being really good at what you do, having high craft is a dominant, what we call a dominant logic in the organization. And people will collaborate with you in the organization and work with you if you're good at what you do. But if you're not respected and you're not considered, on top of your game, you tend to be shunned and ignored socially. So the idea of teamwork is kind of a compensation for, or collaborations and a compensation for, this deeper idea of craft. And this happens a lot in organizations.
Okay. No, I like that a lot. That was going to be one of my questions later on about some best case examples or drill down to specifics. So I like that. Besides going after the myths, you also by name and by title, you go after some books that have been preeminent in this field of the culture industry. But there's one that you actually like, and that is Ed Sheen's Organizational Culture and Leadership book from 1992. Why does that one stand out to you as better than the others?
Well, Ed's work is legendary in the organization development and culture field, and what Ed Schein was writing about actually even earlier than the early 90s, really in the mid 80s, he was bringing the idea that culture really is a set of what he calls basic assumptions. And that's very much in line with the cognitive science of culture and the last 30 years of research in culture, which I mentioned earlier, because what cognitive anthropologists know about culture is that culture is knowledge. So culture is basically background knowledge. It's the metaphor I use is it's the operating system. It's not the apps. And what that means basically is that it runs in the backgrounds. Cognitively speaking, we know a lot of culture or cultures because we personally inhabit many different cultures. Cognitive anthropologists call this a reference system. They call culture basically as a reference system, a system of meaning and knowledge that we draw from, but mostly we draw from it tacitly or implicitly, preconsciously, to make sense and orient ourselves in the world as needed. So the best example, is how do you know when you walk into an elevator not to look at people in the eye? How do you know that? Where do you learn that? It's not taught anywhere. How do you know what to do when you land at an airport in a foreign city in terms of how to hail a taxi back in the days when we were flying? How do you know how to do that, right? Well, and sometimes when you land in a foreign city in some place, for example, in Africa, and you walk out into the street to find a taxi and you are befuddled and bewildered because there's, what you thought you knew about how that goes doesn't work at all. It's the system of meaning and the system of knowledge vis-a-vis hailing taxis is completely different. So the point is, culture is background knowledge that we use as appropriate to make sense of our worlds. And so this idea of what does that knowledge consist of? It consists of essentially basic assumptions, basic beliefs, idealizations. I call those in my book dominant logics, just because the word logic tends to make a little bit more sense to business people. But cultural anthropologists call these, or cognitive anthropologists call these schemas, basically pre-verbal bits of knowledge that we use to make sense of the world and that run essentially in the background. And so Ed was onto it early on by calling these things basic assumptions. And that's been a very powerful way to get at this idea of reference.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Systems.
Okay, well, he must indeed been onto it pretty quickly, because you mentioned all these developments and additional learnings over the last 30 years, and his book is now about 20 years old. Yep. So what are some of those learnings from neuroscience and from cultural anthropology, as a cognitive anthropologist, anything you want to kind of bring in that most is important here that should be really foregrounded in our discussion?
Sure. Well, just to build on the idea, if culture is knowledge, culture is, you know, bits of assumptions and beliefs and idealizations and rationalizations that run in the background, then, you know, the first thing is to think of culture in any organization as really a collection of reference systems or collections of background knowledges. Where does that knowledge come from? That would be the first question. Well, it tends to come from two sources in organizations. One I mentioned already. One is the professionalization of any dominant group. So, you know, software engineers and software companies, actuaries and insurance companies, doctors and HMOs, et cetera. Any dominant professional group in an organization will tend to impart its reference system or its background knowledge to that organization, so that that organization starts to have a belief system and a set of assumptions that are sort of the de facto rules of thumb and implicit logics related to that profession. The other source of knowledge in organizations, background cultural knowledge in organizations, comes from the organization successfully overcoming a difficult challenge. And you see this again and again and again. Organizations that have successfully mastered complexities or challenges in their environment, especially if they're existential challenges, you know, companies that had to do incredible things to even survive, or they solved a very hard technical problem, the values and the knowledge and the beliefs associated with that successful experience or successful product or successful event in their history will tend to become dominant as bits of logic in the cultural reference system of the organization. And there's tons of examples of this. One of the examples that I use is that's very close to home, as I was at Microsoft for many years. Microsoft, of course, invented the operating system. And this is back, predates me, but the invention of the operating system, the technical prowess involved in doing so, and the creation of basically the platform for products, other software products to be built on top of, that idea of platform, that metaphor platform, pervaded the Microsoft culture when I was there, such that the idea of platform was just dominant in everything that the company did. So it was a dominant logic. Software groups, software teams would actually create software such that even if this was, example, a team that was just creating software for a printer driver, they would see their driver as a platform or a basis for other teams to base their code on. So the idea of kind of platform pervades the organization. Now that might be kind of an obscure idea, but it comes directly from this concept of Microsoft having basically created the operating system or the platform for computers to run on. So it pervades a meaningful and successful experience tends to impart cultural schemas or logics to people in groups such that that becomes then the baseline idea or the baseline heuristic for seeing the world.
Okay. And then isn't a third one, and maybe I'm wrong here and you can correct me in a moment, but when we had our preliminary conversation, you were also talking about neural pathways and how they form due to the fact that we are indeed very physical beings. We have physical habits, which is why we have the title we have for this episode, that we are what we do, which reminds me, of course, of Art Buchwald, the satirist, made a joke on, you know, you are what you eat, mm-hmm. and he changed it to you are where you eat, thinking about the lobbyist on K Street.
Yeah.
But exactly. Let's go back to you are what you do, because it seems to me this might be the third leg of this stool besides the kind of professional point of view and that challenge to overcome that informs the dominant logic going forward in a company.
Well, no, it's a great point, Dan, because actually the you are what you do is what enables these examples that I've just been giving you to actually happen. The reason why professionalization tends to dominate a culture, or why a meaningful, successful experience of the collective tends to dominate, is because the habits and routines, the things we do all day long, physically and mentally do all day long, indeed shape how we think. And so if we have spent, you know, a year solving a hard technology problem with a software product, or solved a difficult customer problem, you know, in pumping wastewater, that the habits and routines and practices associated with creating that solution will tend to spread throughout the population. And the reason for that is because the actual neurochemical processes involved in doing that work and doing it successfully will create neural pathways in the collective brains of those humans doing that work, which will then spread throughout the organization through a process called spreading activation, which then allows essentially that knowledge to be shared and distributed and become kind of a de facto logic or the de facto standard for how we do things around here. It comes directly from the work that organizations do. And this is also why, you know, you see, you know, software companies are much more alike than industrial companies. You know, retail product companies are much more like each other than they are HMOs. Companies within industries are much more like each other than not. And this is why it's difficult if you have an industrial company that says it wants to become the next Apple or Google. That is actually quite difficult to do, because unless they change what they actually do all day long, that won't happen.
Sure. So these habits and routines that establish neural pathways for us, how is that? I'm not trying to play devil's advocate, but yeah, we often hear the phrase, you know, talk the talk or you're going to walk the walk. How does this move us down the path of walk the walk?
Well, it gets at why cultures are so hard to change. So you mentioned in all these popular books, you know, over the last 30 years, in fact, you know, successful managed culture change is very rare. There's very little support, even in the business literature, for, you know, a company that successfully changed its culture, unless it was on the brink of death, right? I mean, so one of the reasons why it's so hard is because in order to change neurochemical pathways, if you think about culture as in the brain and culture is what you do, well, to change the neurochemical processes of the collective, there's only one way you can do that. You can't tell people to change. You have to change habits. You have to change routines, or what I call in the book practices. Practices are habits, routines, processes, formal and informal. And that's very difficult to do. The other common myth that I don't write about in the book but happens a lot is that organizations tend to think of culture as a problem for the HR department, or it's a people problem. If we just hire different people, we'll get different culture, et cetera, which is also not true. What's difficult about culture change is that in order to actually change these neural pathways of the collective, you have to change what you do all day long. You have to change the habits, the routines of the organization. And that includes things like how you allocate resources, how you set budgets, how you plan, how you go to market, how you develop and design products, how you think about products to begin with. It includes all the domain of people stuff, like how you hire and promote and develop people. And it includes a whole realm of social acceptance, you know, how you think, how you manage conflict, how you make people feel accepted or not accepted, you know, the sort of normative environment. All of those are habits. All of those involve habits and routines that are quite difficult to change. Because why? Because culture is essentially an evolutionary adaptive response to the environment. And companies that were successful, that are successful, have strong cultures that are there to begin with because the company was successful in adapting to its environment. So the actual habits and routines are expressions of these dominant logics that are there to begin with because the company mastered a problem or a dominant occupational group brought those values to the organization. So it's very hard to change that unless you're highly motivated to do so.
So what you just raised, which is fascinating, brings me to two maybe follow-ons. One is I want to make sure I understand something, because we just talked about habits and routines and practices, and this is very physical. And yet one of your myths is indeed culture is a physical thing. So what's the separation line?
Yeah, that refers to our tendency as humans to think in analogy. So one of the great features of the human brain is that we tend to make sense of one thing in terms of another. So our thinking is fundamentally analogical. And so we tend to think, for example, of mergers and acquisitions. We tend to characterize mergers as fighting or mating or marriage, right? Most abstractions in the world, the economy, society, are made sense of or thought of collectively in reference to something physical or tangible. And this is pretty well established in the neuroscience over the last 20, 30 years. So with respect to culture, we tend to think of culture as a physical thing. How often do you hear, phrases like put it in the culture, or our culture doesn't allow us to do that, or our culture is very marketing oriented, et cetera, as if the culture is a physical or human thing. But the question I ask is, where is the culture? Can you touch it? Yeah. Can you touch the culture, Dan? And the problem with thinking of, it's very common to think of it in that way, and there's nothing wrong with it because it's a feature of human cognition. But the problem with thinking about culture as a physical thing is that it leads us then to think of it as a dependent variable. So if we can just sort of manipulate the culture, put something into it, out will come a desired behavior or desired response. And that is that's a fallacy. It's an attribution error that leads many, many companies astray and waste, millions of dollars and hours and thousands of hours of people's time and resources and energy. It's well-intended, but misguided.
Sure. And there is indeed a lot of waste. You mentioned one point in the book that on average, companies spend about $2,000 plus per employee per year on managing culture. And I can attest from my time in corporate life that it does not work. I've not seen it work. One other follow-up I had, because you kind of mentioned, I think, these categories. And in fact, because you talked about practices, and there were six categories, and I'll just repeat, I think this overlaps with what you just covered a moment ago: planning, management reporting, customer, product, people, and social acceptance. Those were the six. Hate to make it a really simplified question, but is there maybe one of those in your experience that is most important, is really the tipping point that can drive or determine the outcome to maybe get us one of those rare elusive success stories?
Well, I don't mean to be glib, but the answer, of course, is it depends. And,
naturally.
But seriously, a lot of it depends on the context of the organization. It's what it's trying to do. One of the things that I write about in the book, it would be extremely destabilizing for any CEO or leadership team to try to alter all six of those practice areas all at the same time. It would probably be disastrous for the organization unless the organization was in kind of a massive turnaround mode and it needed to do radical things, quickly. But the question this gets us into kind of the how do you approach culture change kind of on the ground. The question I always ask my clients is, where are the highest leverage points? Where would a change in practice make the biggest difference in the short term? And that gets into that's a business decision. There's no right answer. That's a business decision. It's also a little bit of a normative decision, because when you're embarked on culture change, you also want to have some sense of quick wins such that the organization can start to see that meaningful change, meaningful positive change is happening in the desired direction. And sometimes making very visible changes in practices, i.e. changes to practices that are highly visible. Like, for example, how you do your monthly business reviews, for example, which involve lots, often in organizations involve lots of people and lots of time and lots of energy preparing reports about the business, for upper management. Making changes to practices like that could have a high leverage impact if you want to become more entrepreneurial, more streamlined, more faster moving, more agile, reducing the amount of bureaucratic sclerosis in organizations.
Sure.
Could have a big impact. And so going after practices that are embody that or that manifest that could be significant.
Okay, no, that strikes me as fair. So you're looking for quick wins. You're looking for something that's a visible win to help build momentum. And then you still have to get back to what might be the one thing that's the best lever to get to the change you most hope for or need to have as a company. So before we end here, I want to go to the CEOs. That's been implicit in a few of the answers you've given. And you do mention in the book that one of the other hindrances here besides these five myths is executive overconfidence. Yeah. And it seems to me when you talk about the key qualities of future leaders, you mentioned four: self-awareness, psychological flexibility, curiosity, and courage. And you mentioned someone I really respect, Harari, the Israeli historian, who really puts the emphasis on psychological flexibility.
Yeah.
Do you do likewise, and what is meant by psychological flexibility?
Yeah, it's a great question, because when you start to intervene in your own culture and you start to look at, changing practices, just to pick up on your last example, Dan, quickly, and I've seen this happen many, many times with executive teams, quickly you get into this kind of sense of collective executive guilt, where they feel that perhaps, it's their fault that the organization has these practices. It's their fault that the organization is where it is. And that becomes a bit of a barrier to change in and of itself. Most executives I've worked with, want to do the right thing for the organizations. They mean well. A lot of what they have put in place is well-intended. But the psychological flexibility that Harari speaks about is critical here, because you need to be able to have, as a leader, the self-awareness to understand what is you and what is yours and what is not yours. In other words, what is the boundary between you and the organization, the psychological boundary, the emotional boundary? And that requires a healthy amount of self-awareness, self-esteem, and humility to be able to enact the kinds of changes, the kind of practice changes, some of them which may be targeted at practices that you yourself put in place or had been responsible for in some form at some point in the past, and being able to sort of unwind that or change that or make sure that new practices can be put in place that necessarily, that maybe actually rewrites of old habits, can be very difficult. I mean, how many times do we want to admit that we were wrong? How many times do we want to admit that, this is not working? So the humility, the awareness, the self-awareness, the flexibility, the emotional and psychological flexibility to kind of think differently. And as we say in our practice also, hold multiple realities in your head at the same time about possibilities and about the past and about the future becomes very critical. I know that all sounds rather abstract, but it is actually very critical when you think about executive teams who are embarking on culture change. If they don't have some of these attributes, it becomes exceedingly difficult, as you can imagine.
Yeah, no, I think what I'm picking up here is there's the larger environment of the company culture, then there's the micro environment, the microclimate, and between the 2 years of the executive teams.
Yeah,
that 3.5-pound universe called the brain. And you're going to have to go after both of those to make this thing work. I want to thank you, David, so much for your time. There's a lot more we could explore in this book. But I thank you for being my guest here on Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. This has been episode number 46, You Are What You Do. My guest has been David G. White, Jr. He is the author of Disrupting Corporate Culture: How Cognitive Science Alters Accepted Beliefs About Culture and Culture Change, and its impact on leaders and change agents. If you enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. To check out other episodes, you can go to my company's website at www.sensorylogic.com or to the New Books Network's website, where you can find this podcast under its special series programs. Finally, I'd like to conclude every episode with an appropriate epigram. In light of today's topic, I've chosen a quote from Michael Cooley. He is a World Bank Fellow and former Harvard University professor who said of culture, "The culture of a company is the sum of the behaviors of all of its people." Until next time, be kind and stay safe.